History through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, presented on the air and online by Provident Payments, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are stories there that should not go untold. And they don't have to go untold, as long as we're willing to do something about it. Ask a few questions. Take the time to listen as memories from long ago start to take on new life in the here and now. Our idea here is to honor our veterans for their service and their sacrifice, to preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And in that process, not only are we educated, not only are we entertained, but more often than not, we end up inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. Jim Kunkel of Santa Ynez, California, will turn 100 years old next month during the Central Coast Air Fest in Santa Maria. Don't you think we should all be there to celebrate with him? If you heard our last episode, you sure do. I read for you the citation for the Distinguished Service Cross Jim earned with his actions in the air over Aachen, Germany in 1944, but we ran out of time and didn't get to hear the full story of that mission or what followed. So we're going to pick things up when Jim found himself alone as a single P-38 Lightning pilot battling approximately 20 German fighter planes. Feel free to access the first part of Jim's story in podcast form at hometownheroesradio.com, and I'll go ahead and give you that citation again here to set the stage for how the rest of that fateful mission unfolded. While flying as rear man in a squadron of an armed reconnaissance mission, Lieutenant Kunkel noticed that his squadron was about to be surprised by a vastly superior force of enemy aircraft. Unable to summon his leader on the radio, he alone unhesitatingly pulled away from his formation and vigorously attacked the enemy, immediately destroying one of his aircraft. In doing so, Lieutenant Kunkel placed himself in a position to be attacked from the rear and above. When this attack materialized, many hits were registered on his aircraft, which caught fire, burning his face, neck, and hands. Despite his burning plane and the gunfire from enemy planes, Lieutenant Kunkel continued his attack against the vastly superior enemy force and succeeded in destroying a second enemy aircraft, breaking off combat only when forced to parachute to safety when his left fuel tank exploded. The heroism and aggressiveness displayed by Lieutenant Kunkel on this occasion reflect the highest credit upon himself and the armed forces of the United States. So take us back there, Jim. This is really just a 5 or 6 minute stretch of your life that would completely change your life. What was it like in the middle of what you referred to last time as a rat race in the skies over Aachen?
I fired at several aircraft. That first hit that I took set something on fire behind me. I don't know what it was, and I assume that it was the hydraulic tank, which was right behind the cockpit. I'd been hit pretty hard. In fact, a couple came in over my shoulder and knocked my instrument panel out. So we must have been in a pretty tight turn when that happened. I realized that I wasn't going to get much help, so I was very concerned. We didn't have endless ammunition. You had about 30 seconds total for a gun. So I knew there were quite a few targets, so I was picking my target carefully, and the minute I'd feel a hit or something, I'd have to break off whatever I was doing and then look for another target. This went on for what seemed quite a long time, and the P-38 had the only cool air coming into the cockpit came in by your left knee. I'm on the tail of this 190, and I think it was probably a 190 that got me, but there were a couple 109s involved in all of this at the same time. All of a sudden, I see out of my left wing, I got some hits out there from 20. The 20 millimeter would hit, and it would see a flash, and I saw flashes off my left wing, and I'm in a turn, pretty violent turn actually, and he's walking them up my wing, and I can see the hits coming, and it was, you know, it's a microsecond, and all of a sudden this cold air vent by my left knee looked like a blowtorch. That vent came in the leading edge of the wing right by the pilot's nacelle and went through by where your fuel tanks are. And your fuel tanks were sitting in the cockpit. You could reach out and put your hands on the tanks. You were sitting between them. Next minute, next microsecond later, there's this flame can in the cockpit. The next second, I'm falling through a cloud. I don't know which end's up, but I came out the bottom. I knew the clouds were around 5,000 feet because we'd been yo-yoing up and down through them during this combat. I came out the bottom of the cloud realizing that I'm falling looking up. And I thought I was behind the German, there's no question that I was behind the German lines because we were northeast of Aachen, downtown Aachen. Well, I'm behind the lines. I got to be careful about where I, when I open this chute. So I rolled over and fell face down until everything looked real close and pulled the ripcord. I was in the chute. I had a .45 automatic in a shoulder holster. I undid my bottom straps on my chute because I knew I was going to hit the ground running no matter which direction. I was trying to charge that .45 and I didn't realize my hands were burnt. I dropped the thing. And this is, like I say, it's microseconds we're talking about. I came down in a courtyard of a red brick building, and there was a tree in the middle of the courtyard, and my chute hung up on that tree, and I just jerked to a stop. Got out of the chute immediately. Don't remember too much about it. All of a sudden, I realized I had that .45, but I still couldn't charge it because my hands were burnt. I knew I could see when I was falling face down. I watched that damn ground coming up until it looked real close before I pulled the ripcord. And so I knew I could see, but it was getting dark. And I thought, I must have been down here for quite a while because this happened at 5:45, double British summertime. So it should have been real light. And I thought, I've been on the ground quite a while, and I'm still moving. I guess I'm walking, but anyway, I was along a hedgerow. I saw some guys down in a trench, in a depression, and I thought they were Germans. I was not inclined to get into a shooting match with a .45 that's not charged. Again, what seemed a long time was just a second or two, and I realized I saw net on their helmet. Well, our guys had net on the helmet. Well, so did Germans and some in the paratroopers, but that didn't bother me at that time. I thought, boy, these are friends. So I threw my hands up and threw my .45 over the shoulder, and some GI got it. I came down in a little town called Erlemont. The 1st Infantry Division had moved up there the night before and taken the area, and it was in the Siegfried Line. So they had witnessed this whole battle. It was all up right over the top of them. So when they saw my chute, they sent a patrol out to pick me up. And I wasn't maybe a couple hundred yards from their position and a couple hundred yards from the German position. So anyway, they came out, they got out of a foxhole and came and got me, and I ended up in an aid camp. I must have not looked too bad because the commanding colonel of the 16th Regiment took me to his tent, ate something, which stayed down about 15 minutes till I got out of there. But I was pretty badly burned, and my face and hands, and that was about the extent of it. But the infantry, I was pretty dejected about being shot down, what I thought so easily shot down. So I'm going back through the hospital, and they took us from the aid station to a train, and we took a train to Paris. Took me into the American hospital in Paris, and this young lieutenant guy walks up to me and says, "Hell, I know you. We picked you up." And his name was Leonard Scott. He said, "You know, we witnessed that whole fight that you were involved in up there." And he gave me quite a few details. So at least I put up a halfway decent show, I guess. So we stayed together. And you know, Leonard had the Distinguished Service Cross. I didn't know that. We stayed together, and we actually ended up at the Netley Hospital in Southampton, England, together. I remember talking to him. He told me, he said, "You know, I made the landings in North Africa with the 1st Division. I made the landings in Sicily with the 1st Division. They diverted us from Italy to England, and the 1st Division was one of the first to hit the beach in Normandy." He said, "I made the landing in Normandy. 7 o'clock in the morning, I hit the beach. At 7:20, they had me on a boat all shot up, taking me to England." So he said, I didn't last long, and he's a second lieutenant. And I said, well, you started in North Africa. You went through Sicily, and you made the landings in Normandy. And now here you are up in Germany where I was shot down. You saw the fight. Now you're in the hospital. And he said, well, he said, that's the life of an infantryman. And I said, well, didn't they ever promote you? Like first lieutenant? He didn't say a whole lot, but, you know, we weren't in that hospital in England 2 hours, and this pretty nurse showed up, and she had his Class A uniform, dress uniform with her, and he was gone. He didn't ask permission. He didn't do anything. He was just gone. He showed up a week and a half later. So I figured out, I asked him, I said, how often have you been a first lieutenant? And been demoted. In later life, one of my good friends, who was chairman of the board of Flying Tigers Airlines, his wife, she wrote a book based on all the letters he had written home. And I knew he'd been an infantry officer in Europe, but it just never occurred to me. I read the book, and it said on the 16th of September, 1944, he was in Ellendorf, Germany. He was in a bunker. In the letter to her, it said, there was an air fight going on up above us, and all of a sudden, I'm showered with a bunch of shell casings. You know, we kicked out all the shell casings when we're firing. And he says, I said, the hell with this. I went back in my concrete bunker. You know, after reading that, I called him. He'd retired from Flying Tigers. He was down in Palm Springs, and I said, God, I said, I never realized, but, you know, that's where they dug my airplane up, was Ellendorf. And he said, I remember the night well. I remember the fight. I watched part of it. He said that we just got to get together and we'll compare notes and so forth. And, you know, he had a heart attack and passed away before I got to see him. Well, I looked for years for Leonard Scott. I knew he made it through the war, but I couldn't find him. I knew he was from Oregon. I tried to find him desperately. I thought it would have been really great to sit down with him. Never found him. No trace of him anyway. And so a couple of years ago, we're sitting on a Sunday morning, Easter Sunday. Ruth says, I'm going to find him. So she goes to her computer, and within a half hour, she's talking to his daughter. And so, unfortunately, Leonard had passed away, but he went through World War II. He went back in active duty and went through Korea and lived through that. And I found out the story of his Distinguished Service Cross. He got it in Sicily for taking on a bunch of German tanks. He probably should have left them alone. But it's funny how life maneuvers around the way it does.
And you said that, you know, on the ground, you were feeling kind of dejected for getting shot down, as you thought, pretty easily. But then you start to hear these other perspectives, and it turns out you shot down multiple enemy aircraft as part of that mission. And initially, they thought you were an ace in a day. Did I get that right? They thought you got five of them?
Well, that's what the record I have in my briefcase. It's in the file here. I had five confirmed. It's in the record. Well, when the Air Force reviewed all this, you know, to get a confirmation, it had to be witnessed, or you had to have the gun camera film, or you had to have both. Well, I had no gun camera film. All I had was the infantry, and they weren't close up on the action. I mean, you know, you could see an air battle 5,000 feet above you and see the results of it, but they didn't know if there were any other aircraft involved. So they finally, I got two confirmed, and then I heard that they had two confirmed, two probables, and one damaged. But my original, you know, if you'd asked me 10 years ago, before I found this out, if anybody asked me, I said, well, my record says I had five confirmed. Maybe they ran into each other.
Well, and I guess that's the question, because you're the one that lived it, and you talked to guys in the aftermath. Is it your belief that you did get five of them that day?
I have no idea. I didn't know that I got two of them. So count your blessings and take what they give you.
Yeah.
No, I'd fire at them, and I'd only get a burst in before I'd have to break off. And when I first went to England, I met a sergeant pilot in the RAF, older type of guy. He'd gone the whole way through the Battle of Britain. I've looked him up, and he's on the list. He gave me two suggestions. This was before my first mission. He said, if you got a Jerry on your tail, do something violent. Doesn't make any difference what it is. Just do something violent as you, anything you can imagine. And the second one was, watch their exhaust. That's the first indication of what they're going to do. If you get a puff of black smoke, they're going to the ha-ha switch, which was the injection system that for full power, or they're pulling the throttle the whole way off and they're going to try to get you to overrun them. Keep your eye on their exhaust. And I remember using it. Again, the whole thing is just a flashback of what were probably seconds of that. The infantry guys estimated 6 minutes, and they estimated 20-plus aircraft. German aircraft.
And you were the only American aircraft.
My squadron just kept on going, and somebody said, I never saw the report, but apparently one of the fellows said, I thought I saw Jim on fire. And that would have been that first, I'm flying away from him by this time, because I had made a 180-degree turn. So I knew I was, that must have been when I was hit initially that they saw that. But outside of that, they kept up, and about 30 minutes later, our guys are still strafing down on the ground. The whole squadron got hit. They claimed 3 or 4, and the Germans claimed that on the 16th of September, they had this engagement with the 370th group. They claimed 4 P-38 shot down. The Germans were pretty meticulous about confirming their victories. So, but I was the only one lost, and we shot down maybe 3 or 4 of them. I don't know. I don't know if that included the ones I shot down or whether the group shot down. I never saw the combat report, and I never made a combat report. So a lot of how this happened, I don't know.
Well, I think you probably do have perspective on this, though, because you've been, you know, marinating in aviation your whole life, and you have a feel for how unique it is. For one American plane to take on 20 of the enemy and survive, that doesn't happen every day, does it? Have you met anybody else who did something like that?
Yeah, they're going to give the Congressional Medal of Honor to a Navy guy who took on 4 MiGs. I know him. He's a good friend of my Navy friends. I think it's great. And this happened during Vietnam, and it's been a secret operation that he actually took on these aircraft. And I think he shot down 3 of them. They gave him the Navy Cross initially, and then kept the whole thing under wraps. And now they're going to give him the Congressional Medal of Honor.
And I know you're humble about all this, but let me ask it this way. If before you took off that day, if they had said, hey, it's going to be you against a combination of 20 ME-109s and FW-190s, what do you think your chances of survival would be?
I don't know that to this day, I don't think I can answer that. I'd say we're damn good. Where else could they find such a wonderful pilot to take on? So, no, I don't know. It never occurred to me really to think too much about that.
It's time for our first break, but there is so much more to come with 99-year-old Jim Kunkel of Santa Ynez, California. If you ever visit the airfield in France that he took off from on that mission that earned him the Distinguished Service Cross, it's called A1, you'll find a street there named in Jim's honor, and he will be the guest of honor at the Central Coast Air Fest next month in Santa Maria, California. I have all that information linked for you at hometownheroesradio.com. Or you can just go to centralcoastairfest.com, and Hometown Heroes will be right back after this.
Proudly presented by Provident Payments, this is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and a second episode in a row with 99-year-old Jim Kunkel of Santa Ynez, California, a recipient of the Distinguished Service Cross, not to mention the Purple Heart, for the incredible mission he survived in his P-38 over Aachen, Germany back in September 1944. And if people were listening, they heard you say, you know, your plane was on fire, and the next thing you knew, you were plummeting toward the earth. So you don't know how exactly you got out of that P-38?
I don't know. You know, the P-38, we actually had roll-up windows. You had a little crank like a car, and you'd roll your windows up on either side. Then they had a lock on them. And then your top hatch up here, you could pull that, and the top hatch would go. And that was your emergency exit. To this day, and I have thought about it many times, I don't recall reaching for that. I know that I lost my oxygen. I had my oxygen mask on, my helmet. They went at some point, so I didn't take them off. I don't remember releasing, you know, we didn't have any way of, you crawled out. You had to release your belt. I don't remember releasing my belt. I just remember that stack of fire coming out of that. Remember that? So I don't know. I don't know. I don't have any idea really how, and I don't particularly care. Maybe they can give you a shot and you remember. Let's just leave it alone.
Well, and one of the reasons I ask is because from what I've heard from guys who had to do it, the P-38 is one of the most tricky or dangerous planes to bail out of because, you know, a lot of guys would bail out and then get hit on the forked tail, or if they didn't do it quite right, they may not make it to the ground.
Well, that's true, but, you know, honestly, the 38, I never considered it any different than a Mustang or a B-47 because that stabilizer's in the same place. I've known a lot of people that went out of them. We had that dumb, like you look on the stabilizer of that model over there, you got those two weights. Kelly Johnson said that was a waste of good money putting those things on. And he ought to know. I've heard of guys getting tangled up with that. They didn't try to energetically get the hell out of that airplane. Sure, I know guys in Mustangs that didn't make it. B-47s that didn't. So I always thought the 38 was just as easy to get out of as any. Probably, I would guess that I know when this all started, I was in a pretty tight turn because I was pulling some heavy G's. We had what they call a combat flap. And up here on your flap lever, there's a little trigger. The combat flap, you just hit that flap handle and it would stop and give you 20 degrees of combat flap, which was before the flaps actually start down into heavy drag. It increases your effective wing area. And you should never do it over 250 miles an hour. Well, I used it a couple times, and I was not even close to 250. I've been doing 350. You don't worry about that. I mean, I'd rather blow them off than get shot down. But I remember using flaps several times to tighten that turn. I know when I woke up in the hospital, the doctor who developed this system on burns, what they did is they keep the burn open. They take the scab off and they pick at you like that. I remember them picking on me and I thought I was gonna go through the roof. But they used that same thing on Chuck Yeager when he bailed out of that 104. Was that they used that same system. Well, I was one of the first. And every place I went after the aid station, they'd take me down to where all these young kids have been so badly burned in tankers and various accidents and kind of tell them, well, you know, I was badly burned and I had this system and that we're using it on you. You should be fine. And it was just a good PR work.
Yeah, the idea was it minimized the scarring, and I'm looking at you, and I can't tell you ever went through that. But what you went through was pretty significant. You were in the hospital for how long?
Well, I was in the hospital, it happened in September. The end of November, I got out of the hospital in England and went back to the squadron, which was another story. I got out of England, and I didn't have a uniform. My flight suit, they'd cut my good jacket off me. Not a leather jacket, but one of the green ones we had. When they decided to send me to England, well, they gave me a GI uniform, and we'd laugh about it. You know, what they did when you uniform you're wearing, your shirt, your pants, and you go into the hospital, they take them off you. And if they don't cut them off, they send them down to the laundry and wash them and then give them out again. So I was laughing. I had some patched holes in mine. I said, well, this guy got shot here and probably in the butt. So So anyway, when I left England, I had this uniform on, and I didn't have any insignia. I had a cap I'd found, and I didn't have any money. So I ended up in Paris, and I went to the Red Cross, got a room, still didn't have any money. Thought, well, I'll go see the town. So I go down to the Lido Club, the hot spot on the Champs-Élysées. It's still there. Everybody's having a good time. All of the ground-bound quartermaster guys are down there with their French girlfriends, and everybody's having a great time. I used to like to dance. I ended up dancing at the Lido Club. Didn't have enough money to buy a drink. In comes this group of guys. I look at them. They got all Class A uniforms on. And I saw my battle jacket. And I saw my pants. I saw my jacket. These guys were wearing all my clothes.
On three different guys?
Yeah. And so I said, well, you know, I want my clothes back. And so I said, you got any money? And yeah, they had plenty of money. So the hotel right next to the Lido Club, it's long gone. I said, I want a room, and let's go get me a room and at least give me a decent jacket or something, you know, something that shows that I'm not a GI. I went back to the squadron with them then, and I thought, I'm set. I got back there, and they'd just gotten this brand new P-38. J-25 with all of the modifications on it. They said, this is your airplane. And the flight surgeon, Doc Berg, who was a good friend, we were having dinner. He came up to the table and he said, I don't like the way you're walking. So he said, we're going to go over to the hospital tomorrow morning. So I went over to the hospital with him, and I came out. I had a cast on from here the whole way down to my rear end. And I had apparently fractured something, and they said a fourth lumbar or something or other. Back to the hospital I go. Again, I go back through. I end up in England. Got out again. Now, I guess I was determined. I'm back to the squadron. I'll go back and see if I'm fit to fly. And I got back to the squadron, and I was there for a couple of days, and they didn't offer me a new airplane this time. I got orders to go down to Paris. They said, you're going to get a Distinguished Service Cross. That's the last thing they said to me as I walked out the door. I said, what the hell's a Distinguished Service Cross? I didn't know. Anyway, that's the way it worked. I ended up down in Paris, and we had a great time with General Spots. And
Spots pinned it on you?
Spots pinned it on me. He was a good man. But it's like Leonard Scott went in England after he came back from his sojourn with the pretty nurse. They gave out the Purple Heart. And so they gave me my Purple Heart and everything. And they gave Leonard a little acorn. And it was silver. He got his 7th Purple Heart when I got my first. So when I got my Distinguished Service Cross, Joe Myers was there, who became head of the Air Force, J.C. Myers, and everybody referred to him as Jesus Christ Myers. He got his 2nd Distinguished Service Cross. So you're always one behind somewhere.
Well, you're ahead of most everybody. And is it true that somebody told you at some point that you'd never fly again?
Well, that's really how I got home, I guess. They told me that I wouldn't, that second time back, they said, just quit coming back. You're not going to fly again. And Doc Berg said, I just put my foot down, you're not going to fly here. So when I went home, I packed all my stuff and got it back from all my friends, whatever they had of mine. I had all my records. As an officer, you carried your own records. Well, I put my medical records in the bottom of my B4 bag. When I got home, they stayed there, and I went through the depot down. It was the hotel in Santa Monica. So I just took a physical and passed it. So now I'm back on flying duty, and my records are still over in my footlocker in the hangar across the way.
And as a result, you got to be a test pilot, and I know we don't have time to talk about all of it, but were there some highlights or thrills of your time as a test pilot?
Well, yeah, I was up at Portland, Oregon, and we were a sub-depot, and we were a fighter. Portland was noted for being a fighter, what we call an RTU. For fighters, and so I became a test pilot because Colonel Mon says, you're a test pilot. So I got to fly everything. I flew L-5s, I flew Stearmans, I flew B-25s, B-26s. I flew both the B-24 and the B-17. and never flew in the right seat. Always was lucky. I got to fly everything, and we had our moments. I remember going down the Columbia River with one feathered on a B-24, one feathered, one running away, and two working pretty well, and trying to make up my mind whether we were going to go over that interstate bridge on the Columbia River or go under it. And we did go over it, but it was close. We had our moments, and it was all good flying. Yeah, I had a Mustang. The only time I ever had lost an engine in an airplane was in a Mustang. We got the P-51Hs up there, and we were going to take them to Japan. Everything was shooting towards the invasion of Japan. And so we would have taken a group of 51Hs out of Portland. So I had an H quit on me on takeoff. Well, I just enjoyed flying. I loved flying the B-24. I didn't get a whole lot of time in them. I just got test time. And the 17 was just like an old boat to me. It was just a great adventure. You got to fly everything you wanted. And you get in trouble once in a while for flying something you should maybe shouldn't have flown. But they were always, you know, if you're a test pilot, you get to fly them.
Including the first couple jets, right?
I flew the 59, the 80, and the 84. And I ran the first dive bombing tests on the 84. And that got to be a big adventure. We lost a number of people flying the early jets. The 80 was a good airplane, but we had the problems with it. We had stabilizers failing and people trying to bail out. And when you pulled that canopy of emergency, damn canopy had dipped down and knocked you out and you couldn't get out of the airplane. Then engines would, you know, cut your tail off, and you had there's all kinds of things they designed into them. I ran the first dive bombing tests on the 84. I had to run the 300, 400, 500, and 600 mile an hour indicated release. And on the 600, it was typical of a test program. Everybody's in a big hurry and they're all pushing it. They had the test range was at the cold weather hangar, which I don't know if you've ever familiar with it, but it's the big hangar at Eglin. It was built in 1946. And they can take the temperature down to below zero, 40 and 50 degrees below zero, or they can raise the thing, or they put the static airplane in there and test it for cold weather operations. So I'm going to run this first test, which is, you know, trying to hold a jet coming down from 10,000 feet at 300 miles an hour is like impossible, but you do the best you can. So we walked the range, and they had the cold weather hangar set up, and they had this false wall in it, so they could actually put a plane on jacks and fly a full mission on it in that hangar without it ever moving. They could fire the guns out that went down through a canvas thing and down the range, but they wanted to use the range for this first 300 mile an hour test. So I walked the range with them, and they had some markers, and I picked out the marker. I picked out my aim point. There was a truck parked back away from the hangar, and so I thought, well, I'll just use this as a starting point on my pull through on the bombing. And by that time I was getting pretty proficient at dive bombing. I took off, and there were towers after me. Can you hurry up? Can you get up to 12,000 feet and you pull? We'll give you 28 seconds to do something. So I get up there and I roll over and I pick out my target, and I pick out the target that I had picked out on the ground. I picked up the truck and I come screaming down at 300 miles an hour trying to slow it up the whole way, and release the bomb, no problem. Make my break, come in, land. I hadn't been in the air more than 20 minutes and taxied in, and God, everybody's all up, all excited. I almost bombed the cold weather hangar. So I said, what in the hell do you mean? They said, well, look how close you were to it. And so I got down there, and I'll be a son of a gun. I'd picked out markers that I was using as a target. I picked out the truck. Somebody moved that truck. And so I'm about two markers short and awful close to that hangar. My comment was, did I hit the target? Yes. Well, then what the hell are you worrying about?
I think by now you're probably getting an idea of just how much fun it'll be to meet Jim Kunkel at the Central Coast Air Fest next month in Santa Maria, California. Again, all that information is online, but you wouldn't have the chance of celebrating his 100th birthday with him there if he did not survive the next test in that primitive jet he was serving as a guinea pig, a test pilot in, and we'll hear that chapter of this remarkable pilot story when Hometown Heroes comes right back after this. Do you ever have those moments where you realize you've been settling for less than the best for far too long? Sometimes we just accept the status quo without looking around for better ways to do things. And I've got to tell you, when it comes to your money, I believe I found a better way with EECU. Take a look at myeecu.org and you'll see why. EECU is not a bank. It's a nonprofit credit union that's all about taking care of you, the member. That's one of the reasons EECU just keeps growing and growing. Close to 300,000 members now in 10 different California counties. Over 30,000 ATMs, free mobile banking. And what I really love is how EECU always goes above and beyond to serve the community. In 2013, the leadership and generosity of EECU helped establish Central Valley Honor Flight. More than 1,000 veterans now have gotten to see their memorials in Washington, D.C. for free. And that's just one example of the community involvement EECU takes oh so seriously. Pick up the phone and become a member today. 1-800-538-3328. That's 800-538-3328.
Honoring veterans from sea to shining sea, you're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler, brought to you by this local station and its sponsors, and presented everywhere, on the air and online, by Provident Payments, one of the fastest-growing payment consultants in America. Connect today at providentpayments.com.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes, getting ready for our final approach, if you will, on this two-part conversation with legendary pilot Jim Kunkel. We've heard about his time as a P-38 pilot in Europe during World War II, including that incredible mission in which he earned the Distinguished Service Cross and somehow avoided being killed or captured. Jim later became a test pilot, and when we left off, he was in an escalating series of dive bombing tests in one of America's early jets, the P-84.
The 600-mile-an-hour went to hell on me. The same question, everybody's in the same big hurry and hasn't changed a bit. Now I gotta do 600 miles an hour, indicated. So I rolled in at 12,000 feet, picked it up, and I'm coming down, picked up my target, pulled through on it, released the bomb, and I had two tip tanks on the airplane. And the first tanks that were mounted like this, rather than down underneath, they were mounted like that on the 84. And so they'd cut windows in the tank and put cameras in it so they could photograph those bombs coming off the airplane. When I started to pull out, I came up, all I heard this horrible banging. I mean, just bang, 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 and that damn nose of that airplane snapped up. And they'd given me this P-1 helmet, which I hated, hard hat, and they had to wear it down at Eglin, and the damn thing came down over my nose with my oxygen mask, which we always wore. I couldn't see, the airplane's banging, nosed up, and I'm in hell of a condition. And I finally got everything stabilized and under control. Didn't have no idea what happened. Came back in, and the airplane's not flying real well, and it wanted to stall on me. So I got it on the ground, taxied up, and the crew chief, before I even could get out of it, he's all excited. Half your rivets under the underneath your wing are gone. And he said, look, they're bent. That was the start. The airplane apparently snapped up on me. When I released the bomb, they had these short little bomb racks. When you released, that bomb rack would snap back up into the wing to give you a clear wing, fully cleaned up airplane. Well, by the camera, that damn bomb, when the rack went up, the bomb went up and was just pounding the underside of the wing like that. That was that pounding I heard. And the fact that it snapped up like that, I had no idea what the cause of that was. But over the course of the next few weeks, we had reason to really explore this. The bomb thing we could understand. We had some oscillation in the tanks that the camera showed, but we couldn't figure out, or at least I couldn't figure out, or nobody at Eglin could figure out why that nose snapped up like that. This was on a Saturday that I did this. I grounded our airplane. I was from Tactical Air Force, so the airplanes were in my care. So Eglin had this big firepower show coming on Tuesday, following Tuesday, and I was supposed to do the dive bombing for that show. And I said, well, my airplanes, until we find out what happened, we don't know what happened on that thing, and we're going to find out before we start doing anything more. Well, these are tactical airplanes. We want to know about this. They got a hold of Ballinger, who is chief test pilot at Republic, who was a friend of mine. He flew a brand new airplane down from Long Island for the plant to Eglin to do this thing on Tuesday. In the meantime, all day Sunday, we were having meetings with the commanding general of Air Materiel Command over what happened with this airplane. Anyway, Cy Johnson, who was head of fighter tests, decided he would fly the mission I was to fly with the new Republic airplane, which was assigned to them at Eglin. So that's the way it set up. I kept my airplanes, under a Red Cross. So comes Tuesday morning, we go out to the range. Gosh, they had all these dignitaries from Washington. They had top people from the Air Force. They had Navy people there for this big firepower show, and they were going to fly these B-29s in formation as part of the show. And so Cy Johnson took off with the P-84. He climbed up over the thing, and he made his run, but he didn't drop. And he pulled out, and the commanding general was there of Air Materiel Command. He called Cy, and he said, well, the P-80s, they were supposed to come past the stand right with the B-29s and show the difference between a jet fighter and a heavy bomber. My good friend Lopez was leading the 80s, and he missed the mark. And so the commanding general called Cy, who was head of fighter tests in the B-84, and he said, Cy, would you pick up those 80s and make that run again? So Cy, okay, came around, and he came in and right in front of the stands, and he's coming up underneath behind the B-29s, and damn wing failed. And in one, they had 35 millimeter cameras on them, movie cameras, and in just like one or two frames, that airplane did a 180 degree roll, and the other wing came off, and the airplane just disintegrated right in front of the stands. And so this stopped everything as far as the P-84, because they grounded them right then for everybody. So again, it was the old question, what happened? Well, we didn't know, and it finally worked out. Number one, Chuck Yeager and his group at Edwards knew about the snap up at the critical Mach on the 84, which was like 0.81, you couldn't exceed it. The nose would snap up on you if you were, well, trying to make a 600-mile-an-hour dive with an indication from the indicator. 600 miles an hour is all guesswork. It's not calibrated. I had no idea how close I was to the Mach. We didn't have a Mach meter. Edwards knew this, but they didn't tell anybody. The factory knew the damn thing snapped up. We never heard about it. Well, it cost Cy Johnson his life. One good thing is they named the administration headquarters at Eglin Field, to this day, is called Cy Johnson in honor of his name. It was damn close to being Kunkel.
Well, that's what I was going to say. It almost cost you your life, and we've heard a few of those stories, and I don't want to keep you forever. Thank you for so much of your time, but I have a few more questions for you. You're going to be 100. In the middle of October. That's a long time. When you think back over all of that, is there something that, from your perspective, you are most proud of or most thankful for?
Yeah, we built some nice projects. Certainly had an excellent life. Got a wonderful wife. I had to get that in. No, I'd say, you know, a family, they're all interested in aviation, and no, it's just been a wonderful life.
And you're not done yet, and that's clear. I mean, when we landed here, you were pushing the airplane back to its parking spot here, and I think you're looking forward to this air show in Santa Maria, too, aren't you? Tell us why people listening, and they're listening in Bakersfield and Fresno and San Luis and all over California, why should they come to Santa Maria for this air show?
Well, because I think it really is a top air show. I think my grandson's done a terrific job. Santa Maria has been very helpful, and they all seem to be so proud of the fact that that was the largest P-38 training facility in the U.S. when the war ended. It's a good show. It's their top people.
Is there a particular aircraft that's going to be there that you're most anticipating seeing?
Depends on our old friend Steve Hinton. I think Steve will be there with the P-38 from Wings of Fame, and he may even get a couple more. I know they'll try.
Does that mean you're going to be in that plane?
I don't know. I wouldn't mind. It's pretty damn uncomfortable if he'd trade places with me.
If he'd let you fly and he'd sit on your shoulder?
He can keep me straight from behind.
And we can kid about it, but I'm sure a lot of people are wondering, seriously, you know, you're going to be 100 years old during that air show. That's when your birthday is, in mid-October. But if they left you alone and let you walk over to that P-38, would you be able to take it off and fly around and land it?
I don't think there's any question about it. I would approach it very slowly. I'd like to spend the whole day sitting in it. I think right now I can take a blindfold test on it, and I know where everything's located. I can still remember my checklists, and it doesn't fly that much different than my 320 Cessna. No, I'd love to fly it, but I can't expect a guy with a $7 million airplane, that's what they got for the last one, is going to give me his airplane, the chances of whether I can fly it or not. But it was an easy airplane to fly as long as everything worked. No, I'd love to fly one again.
And is there anything else that I didn't ask you about that you think is really important for people to know?
I think that the support that our veterans, and let's talk about some of these young kids that on the wall, you'll notice the Navy is well represented. And I've been on the carriers with them, been to the officers club, the O club together, and I had all the girls in the down at Miramar at the officers club on Saturday night, all the girls with the tight skirts and the high red shoes. And those guys that fly these jets today, they're a great group of people. Even Ruth has had her experience with them. They put her in a chair, the whole squadron, and they sang. Yeah, I got a picture of her with all these Navy guys down on her knee, and she's lost her loving feeling. I could have told them that.
Oh, classic. And you haven't lost your sense of humor either. Let me ask you real quick. Ruth mentioned the Legion of Valor. So a lot of people don't even know what the Legion of Valor is, but it's a very select club. To be a part of it, you have to have earned a Navy Cross, an Air Force Cross, a Distinguished Service Cross, or the Medal of Honor. The time that you've spent with those other gentlemen who have all done things like you did, risked your life for our country, lived to tell about it, what has that meant to you over the years?
Well, I think it's really very heart-filling that, you know, there's some real heroes in that organization. It's like my friend Charlie Plum, 6.5 years of his life in a hellhole, and me, 6 minutes. Gosh, that, you know, it's hard to, 6 minutes is not enough to be a real hero. I've been, you know, being adopted by the Navy, and one of my best friends other than Charlie was Denny Wisely. He was an admiral and led the Blue Angels and commanded the JFK carrier. Had a big reputation in as a fighter pilot, shot down some MiGs, real hero type. But being associated with these younger guys, even more so than the Air Force, it's been around the Navy guys and Navy ladies, these lady fighter pilots. I've been very privileged to have the opportunity to talk to them. And it's amazing. The guys never really come up with the one question. And it seems like every one of the feminine fighter pilots have asked this question that I've been associated with is, what do you do when the whole thing is hopeless? Now, I would guess in my situation, it was pretty damn hopeless. There was no way I could make a run for it. So you ride out the storm, whatever it is, you stick with it. But you got to rely back on that training. I told him my experience when I was a junior birdman in the Air Force. 20 minutes before I went to sleep, I'd think, what do you do in any given situation? If you lose an engine on takeoff, what are you going to do? Have a plan ahead of you. And, you know, that plan, it's better to have a plan than no plan at all. I'm afraid my friend Smoot, who lost it on this Reno airplane, was trying too hard to save the airplane, and he stalled it. And that was the end of it. But then again, he could have landed straight ahead and have a cartwheel on him. You don't know. It's luck of the draw. But I think that thinking of these young kids that are day in, day out, they're landing on these carriers and they're doing a good job, and the Air Force the same way, they've got high marks coming. Hopefully, they're being appreciated more than our Vietnam guys were appreciated. But, you know, being on that carrier, boy, that opened my eyes for 7 days. And that's the ground crew. That's the deck crew. That's the guys that would fire you off the thing. That top drawer on that carrier is a pretty busy place.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's my one final question. You just said the luck of the draw there a second ago, and I don't want to put thoughts in your head or words in your mouth, but I'm just curious how you really see it, because you've told us a lot of situations where that could have been it for you. Way back in World War II as a test pilot later, I'm sure there have been some since then. Do you see all that as just chance or luck? Do you think someone's pulling some strings for you? What's your view of that reality?
I think it's the luck of the draw. Why did my wing not fail on that 84 and Cy Johnson's did? Why did my engine run 10 seconds longer than somebody else's did? You know, you can think all day you're the world's leading aviator, but that's not going to buy you much. So it's the chance. I'm not a real prayer meeting Christian, but I do believe in it. But I also don't believe that you should do a lot of praying for yourself. I think when you get up to the Golden Gate, if they just say, I'm going to stand on the record.
It is quite a record, and here's hoping that day is a long way off. Some days that are getting a little closer, October 15th and 16th, the Central Coast Air Fest in Santa Maria, California, where Jim Kunkel is going to celebrate his 100th birthday. I'm hoping to get there and hope you'll consider it too. Thanks again to Jim Kunkel and his wife Ruth, as well as pilots Peter Mercino and Harold Gallagher for flying me down to Kunkel Field and the family hangar in Santa Ynez to conduct this interview. We talked about the Legion of Valor that Jim is a part of, and the repository for the Legion of Valor is the Veterans Memorial Museum in Fresno, California. There is so much to explore there at that free museum about so many heroes, so a visit there would be well worth your time also. I have that linked for you at hometownheroesradio.com as well. One final thank you to you for listening today. I'm Paul Leffler, reminding you once more that freedom is not free.
To let Paul know about a veteran in your life, visit hometownheroesradio.com and click on Suggest a Veteran. Today's program has been brought to you by Provident Payments. Give your business the edge only their personalized service can deliver at providentpayments.com.